You're listening to the London Buddha Centre, talks and seminars from our home in Bethnal Green, exploring Buddhism in a way that is relevant to contemporary life.
It's quite hot, and in a way that helps you to tune in to what it was actually like for the Buddha at the time of his awakening, because it was in the hot season. It would have been really sweltering, probably much worse than this. So you can imagine how keen he was to find a really shady spot. Hence the Bodhi tree. Shade, excellent shade. But the anniversary of that incident, of that experience, of that occasion, the Buddha's enlightenment, is actually on Tuesday, to be exact. Buddha Day this year is on Tuesday. Why is it on Tuesday? It's not because of the date, it's because it's the full moon day. So the full moon day of the month, usually of May, every year is the anniversary of the Buddha's enlightenment. And there's a guy down here with an orange t-shirt which says it all starts here. And that is where it started. It started, Buddhism began. Buddhism began at that moment of the enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. And a bit later on, I want to say what the moment was. We know that the date is under the full moon day, but what was the moment of the enlightenment? And this is very interesting, according to Buddhist tradition, as to what that moment should be. But I'll tell you that later on. Now, I've been watching the moon night by night over the last 7 days or so, moving from being a half moon, and then gradually it's a bit like it's getting pregnant. It's sort of bulging out like this, moving towards that fullness that will start on Tuesday when it becomes the full moon, the anniversary of the Buddha's enlightenment. Now, this light of the moon is a very important sort of symbol in Buddhism, as well as being the occasion of the enlightenment. In fact, it's called the enlightenment. That's the word that we use, at least in the West. But the image of light is very prominent in Buddhism to refer to the awakening, the growing of awareness in somebody. And you probably heard it if you were listening to all the readings from the Lalitavistra earlier on today. It comes up again and again, the sense of light, clarity, radiance, illumination, and so on. But there's a bit of a paradox here, because the enlightenment was a nighttime occurrence, a nighttime event. It wasn't a daytime event. It wasn't under the sun. It was under the moon. It was, in a sense, in the darkness. And in fact, it was during an all-night meditation in the open air, in the countryside. Now, thunderstorms might make this difficult, but if you got a chance, imagine that. Go out into a wood, sit under a tree, and meditate all night, especially with the full moon overhead. Imagine that experience. I really do recommend it, the all-night sit. And then the sense of the moon just passing over you as you sit there. This was the Buddha's experience. And I think it's really helpful sometimes to try to evoke what it was like for the Buddha, what it was like for the Buddha's own disciples, what it was like for people in India trying to practice all those many, many years ago. Now, for me, I actually like the darkness. I even like the darkness when there isn't a full moon. There's a sort of a velvety feeling. Have you ever done that, where you get up in the middle of the night and it's completely dark and you have to find your way around by feel? And when I was very small, I was scared of the dark. But as soon as that was overcame, I loved it. I loved just to be there in the velvet darkness, which in a way is a bit perverse, because that darkness represents not awareness, but unawareness, not being able to see. Although perhaps it's an awareness that is developing through your other senses, so we don't get completely caught up in the sight, the sense of sight. Anyway, we are celebrating this darkness, the dark night, but the night of the enlightenment. It's the month just before the rainy season, when the Buddha Day full moon comes out. So what you've also got, as well as the heat, the hottest time of the year in India, you've also got the promise of the monsoon. And when the monsoon rains arrive, it is, well, we know what it was like. If you're out last night, the thunder starts, the lightning starts, the torrential rain comes down. So there's both of those are present in the period of the Buddha's enlightenment. So all night, the Bodhisattva, the Buddha-to-be, sat meditating. As the full moon drifted slowly from its rising to its setting. And he is actually facing the moon rise. He's facing east, according to most accounts. So it's as if as he starts his meditation, he sees the full moon right in ahead of him. And as if you've got any astronomical knowledge, you'll know that as the full moon rises, the sun sets on the other side of the sky at exactly the same moment. So you can imagine the darkness coming, but the new sort of wonderful, pale, soft, compassionate light of the moon replacing that blazing light of the summer sun. So imagine that you came across that scene of the man sitting under the tree. Imagine maybe you got a bit lost and you were wandering through the woods and there you saw somebody just sitting doing his all-night meditation in the moonlight, sitting very, very still under that tree, sitting on a heap of hay, but with a great turmoil going on inside him. And this is what we've been hearing about in the readings. Every lingering doubt that he had, every longing that he had, every trace of hostility, it's all flying at him. Turmoil. He looks very still, but inside there is this incredible turmoil. I'm assuming that we wouldn't see the hordes of Mara and Mara's daughters and the Earth Goddess. This is presumably an illustration of his inner experience. There's an army attacking him, the army of Mara. And then he becomes calm. Then after this period of great turmoil, he becomes calm. And this is the way it's described, that moment, in another biography of the Buddha. We've heard the one called the Lalitavistra today, another one called the Buddha Charita, written by Ashvaghosha, a great poet and playwright in Sanskrit of medieval India. And this is the way he describes it. Now that he'd defeated Mara's violence by his firmness and calm, the Bodhisattva, possessed of great skill in meditation, put himself into meditative absorption, intent on discovering both the ultimate reality of things and the final goal of existence. After he'd gained mastery over all the degrees and kinds of absorption, that is meditation, three things happen. The first thing that happens, according to the accounts, he remembered thousands of births. He remembered his past as though living it over again. And when he'd recalled his own births and deaths and memories in these various lives of his, the sage, full of pity, and this is the second thing that happened, full of pity, turned his compassionate mind towards other living beings. And he thought to himself, again and again, they must leave the people they regard as their own. They must go on elsewhere, and this without ever stopping. Surely this world is unprotected and helpless, and like a wheel, it turns round and round. The Bodhisattva turned his meditation to the real and essential nature of the world. Alas, living beings wear themselves out in vain. Over and over again, they're born and they age and they die. They pass on to a new life. And what is more, greed and dark delusion obscure their sight, and they're blind from birth. Greatly apprehensive, they yet do not know how to get out of this great mass of ill. So this is the reflection that he has when he considers others. So that's the second part of his experience. The third part, when the great seer had comprehended the conditioned arising of events, how everything comes about through the collection of conditions. Everything is understandable. It's in patterns that you can understand. When he'd comprehended this, then he'd achieved a correct knowledge of all there is to be known, and he stood out in the world for the first time as a Buddha. He passed through all the meditative absorptions, quickly reached their highest point, and from the summit of the world downwards, he could detect no core of selfhood anywhere. Like the fire when its fuel is burnt up, he became tranquil. He'd reached perfection And he thought to himself, this is the authentic way on which in the past so many great seers, who also knew all higher and lower things, had travelled on to the ultimate and the real truth. And now I've obtained it. So that's the account from the Buddhacharita, which means what the Buddha got up to. And I just want you to hold in your mind that image that he brings in, the Buddha brings in, at least quoted as bringing in at the end, of the great way, this way, because I'm coming back to that later. And in a way, the central metaphor that the Buddha used during his teaching was the one of a path, a way, not just a way that he had trodden, but as he said, many in the past had trodden, though it had been forgotten, and now he had done it, and now he wanted to demonstrate it, to show it to others. So there is a way, there is a path that you can tread. So I'll come back to that one later. So this is the three watches of the night, the three phases of the enlightenment experience. This is a very dodgy thing for me to try to do because I'm not enlightened myself. I don't understand what the enlightenment consisted in, but there are actually a lot of accounts. Presumably, at least some of them go back to the Buddha himself or to other enlightened people who said, what is enlightenment like? What happened on that night under the full moon, under the Bodhi tree? On that hot night. And in particular, what's very often mentioned are these three phases of understanding that the Buddha came to. The first one is he understood his own conditioning. He looked back over his past. He realized, why am I like this? Why do I do these things? Why do I make these mistakes? And by just spending time reflecting, understanding his own roots, the roots of his experience in the decisions he'd made in his life, in the things that had happened to him in his life, perhaps in past lives as well, he realized that's what I'm doing, isn't it? And he also realized some of those things are quite destructive. I'm mistaken, they don't work. Let's just stop it. I'm going to stop doing that. And then the second watch of the night, what he understood was the conditioning of other people. It's all very well coming to a self-understanding, but just as important in Buddhism, as I'm sure you know, is compassion, is an interest in others. And that an interest in others means learning to understand others, to realize that people are different from us, but deep down, in a way, we're all the same. We're all facing the same challenges, and we're all going through the same phases and struggles and so on, and we've all got the same basic potential for awakening. So he looked at the conditioning of others. He presumably thought of all the people he'd known and so on. Maybe he thought in principle, somehow he felt, my understanding of all the people I've worked with and practiced with through my life, that gives me a sense that it's not just to do with me. This is something which applies to everybody, this conditioning process. And the reason people find themselves in all sorts of situations is partly because of the choices they've made in their life, the directions they've chosen. And maybe I can help them to find directions, to find choices that are going to make their lives better. Maybe even will take them to awakening. And then the third watch of the night, he realized the whole complex of conditioned arising as the basic thing that underlies everything in the world. Not just his own life and his own experience, not just that of other people, but of animals, of stars and planets, of the world, of thunderstorms. It's all there. It's all part of this condition process. And with that realization, it said he ended the sores, the asavas. Asava means something that oozes. It's a horrible word. And what it means is that it's as if we have got unhealed wounds on us that are sort of oozing. And those unhealed wounds represent the fact that we are facing so much difficulty, so much suffering in our lives, so much that is missing, that seems to be not there, so much pain and lack. And he realized, no, that can be healed. And the healing of those sores, those asavas, was the culmination of that night of enlightenment. And all the while, the full moon, remember it rose in front of him, is wheeling overhead. And you've got the dappled shadows of the moonlight under the tree, really beautiful. There's a river, I can't remember if that was mentioned in the Lalitavistra or not, but there's a river just in earshot, not far away at all. So imagine the splashing of the water in the river, very refreshing on a really hot night. A warm breeze, the rustling leaves. The leaves rustle in the Bodhi tree. and maybe all the flowers that had settled around him during the assaults of Mara, maybe that the perfume is coming up from those petals, the garlands hanging in the air and so on, that so beautifully depicted on the shrine. And then the moon behind the tree approaches the horizon. It's looking huge and orange, like the moon is when it starts to set. And the Buddha doesn't see it, though. It's behind him. He's still got his eyes closed. And then the sky starts to lighten in the east. And at that moment, according to the story, there arises a star. A star rises in the east, in front of him. So bright, so white, so soft, a beautiful star, a simple point of light, far brighter than any of the other stars in the sky, the morning star, which in India is called the star of healing, Asaditaraka, the star of healing. And in a way, this is said to be the Buddha's moment of enlightenment, when his eyelids slowly part, the enlightenment process complete, and the very first light that comes into those newly enlightened eyes is the light of the star of healing, the morning star. A brilliant point of light, the very first object ever grasped by the mind of an enlightened human being, at least in living memory, according to the old story. So that is the enlightenment. Isn't that a beautiful image, that sense of the morning star? And just, you know, again, it's difficult to imagine being the Buddha, but imagine you're there, you've gone through this incredible experience, everything has fallen away, you're completely free, completely at peace, you open your eyes and whoosh, there's the star of healing. Now, if you imagined yourself not being the Buddha, but watching the Buddha while this happens, of course, you'll also see his eyes as he opens, the eyes of a new kind of person. An awakened person, a Bodhi, just awakened. Bodhi means awakening. And when you look, you see two dark, unfathomable pupils in his eyes. And the word for pupil is the same in Sanskrit and Pali as the word for star. The word is tara, tara. So you look into his pupils, and of course what you see reflected is the star of healing. Little bits, pinpoints of light. Again, a very beautiful image, I think. So Asaditaraka, the star of healing, is reflected very deeply there. Now, I'm just picking up one or two things. You know, probably if you listened to the readings earlier, there are probably lots of things that struck you from, what's that about? What's going on there? I'm just picking up one or two things from the time of the Enlightenment. And I think this is always worth doing. It's a very, very rich sequence of stories and teachings. And I'm sure they're all significant. I'm not sure that I've got the significance right, but in a way you don't need to sort of necessarily explain them, but you just have that sense. There he is, very hot, sitting under the tree. The tree is very important. The moon is very important. You know, the sunset is very important. And then the star of healing, I think, is very important. What do the incidents mean to you? I'll just remind you of some of the things that have led up to this point. I'm not going to go into any detail with this, and I'm sorry if you missed the readings. So he's left home, he's practicing, he knows he wants to move towards nirvana, he wants to deal with the problems of suffering, old age, death, and so on. And he's been trying all sorts of things. He's been practicing austerities, which means self-punishment is his practice, starvation. He's been trying that with a group of friends, but he realizes it hasn't worked. He's decided to eat properly. And this is where the rice pudding comes in, because very fortunately for him, he meets Sugata, and she gives him this rice pudding. And so he's now nourished, and he's left alone, completely alone. And then he has the memory of the jambu tree. He has the memory of his boyhood meditation experience, and that gives him the clue as to where he's going to go. With this night of working on enlightenment. So therefore he says, okay, what am I going to do? This is it. I'm going to go for it now. I know where it is. I haven't done it yet, but I've got to do it. So he chooses a spot. He chooses this beautiful wood by the river, near the village where Sukhati lives. So you know, we assume that she carries on providing him with, maybe it's rice pudding every day, I'm not sure, but with nourishing food, which is very kind of her. sorry, Sujata, I should say. Sujata's gift. His choice of the Bodhi tree. That's the tree he chose to meditate under. His resolution. Blood may dry up, flesh may wither, but I shall not stir from this spot until I've gained complete awakening. That's his vow. And then Mara's insidious questioning, and then the calling of the earth goddess to witness that he was indeed ready for meditation. The assaults of the hosts of Mara, all their weapons turning into flowers hanging in the air. And then that tremendous night of deep meditation, then the light of dawn with the star of healing, the beautiful star of healing appearing in the sky. So there's a lot of questions that arise when you think of these incidents, which I'm just going to put in your minds to think about. You know, I'm not going to provide with answers. So when his friends left him and he decided to eat properly, he was alone. Why alone? Why did he have to do this alone? Did he? Maybe it's just coincidence, but there's something about the aloneness that I think is important. And then there's the memory of his boyhood meditation experience, which had happened probably 20 years earlier. Now, why had he not remembered that before? You know, he'd been trying meditation with his Indian meditation teachers using these traditional meditation methods, which, you know, got him into really weird altered states of consciousness, but hadn't taken him to enlightenment. But suddenly this memory comes up. Why then? Why did he choose the woods? Why did he choose to meditate? Why didn't he go to a building? Why did all the great events of the Buddha's life happen under trees in the open air? Very interesting, that one. What is the significance of Sujata, who appears there with the food? Another story in itself, very interesting story of her life and what she was up to and why she was there. And then there's the tree itself. The Bodhi tree, Ficus religiosa, a type of fig tree, is now always associated with the Buddha to the extent that it's called the Bodhi tree. That is the name of that species of tree now because it's so famous for the Buddha having gained enlightenment under it. The tree of awakening, in other words. A tree that same tree lived for many hundreds of years, and a cutting from it is still alive in Sri Lanka. You can actually go and see a cutting of the original Bodhi tree. Which is the oldest dated tree in the world. And what about his resolution? Blood may dry up, flesh may wither, but I shall not stir from this spot until I've gained complete awakening. Which seems a bit much, in a way, that terrifying finality. How did he know he could do it that night? Would he have died, you know, if he'd failed? Would he have, you know, if he'd not got up and gone for a pee at some point and got some food and some water? And how could he make that commitment on that particular night? And what about Mara's questioning and the earth goddess coming to witness that he was ready? Are they figments of his imagination, Mara and the earth goddess? Are they symbolic? If so, what do they symbolize? And then the assaults of the hosts of Mara. What is going on there? I think we heard from Danyuta that maybe that is to do with anger, irritation, hatred that he's having to deal with. But then what does it mean when all that turns into flowers and hangs in the air or scatters around him in the form of flower petals? And also the events I've described of that tremendous night of meditation, the final night under the full moon. And the culmination, the end of his quest, the first moment of Buddhism, he opens his eyes to see the light of dawn, the beautiful star of healing in the sky. Again, that's all these are significant, I think. And just sort of possibilities of little bits of reflection you could do as a good thing to do around Buddha Day. Just to, maybe just one of those things just strikes you. What's going on there? What does that feel like? What does that tell me? It all seems very significant. And it's good not to explain it too quickly. But I think the images touch you deeply. They lighten up your imagination. I will say more just about the dawn, just about the Star of Healing. The most important moment in the history of the planet from the point of view of a Buddhist, which is quite a thing to think about. That's what we're celebrating today. Maybe because Buddhists feel very proud and aggrandized about their religion, but it's more that from a Buddhist point of view, nobody had discovered awakening yet. Extraordinary things had happened in consciousness, You know, the simple consciousness of animals had appeared, self-awareness had appeared in some of the most sophisticated and intelligent animals. But so far, nobody had broken through that self-awareness to the complete awareness of enlightenment, another level appearing. So very, very significant in the history of the planet. And thank goodness that he was able to do that and then to communicate it to many others since. So you've got that sense that for every dawn, for millions and millions of years, the light of the dawn had swept across the fields and the forests, driving the darkness before it, but it hadn't included an enlightened being. But now on this dawn, there was a new kind of light, a light of the mind, a sensitive, compassionate, fully aware light of the mind. And here on the shrine, we've got these candles. And the candles, the reason we have candles on a Buddhist shrine, as you probably know, is to remind us of the only thing that truly illuminates the world. You know, we think what illuminates the world is LED lights, it's the sun, it's the moon, all that kind of stuff, it's fires. But no, it's not. The only thing that illuminates the world is awareness. All these things could be blazing away like anything. If there was no awareness, it would have no significance. It's something that Einstein once said, I think, was that without the illumination of the human mind, the world would just be a pile of shit. I've got the quote slightly wrong, but something like that. The shit bit is correct. He did say that. So they're a reminder, these candles, of the fulfilled awareness of a Buddha. Light, beautiful light. There's so many kinds of light. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha says, in the day shines the sun, in the night shines the moon, when in his bright armor the warrior shines, but when meditating shines the sage. But shining all day, shining all night, is the radiance of an awakened one. So we've got two very strong symbols of light in traditional Buddhism, of the light of awareness, that is, which is the moon and the sun, the light of the moon and the light of the sun. The changeable moon, the changeable moonlight is the Bodhisattva, the Buddha to be, and that moon was sinking in the west behind him as he sat there. But then we get this new, very special, very specific soft light of the Star of Healing at the moment of enlightenment rising in the east. And then soon after that, the sun rose. A sun ready to blaze a dazzling path across the sky, as the Buddha himself was ready to blaze a trackless path of compassionate activity for the next 45 years until he died. So quite a road ahead of him. Now, the full moon's radiance is very strange, very unworldly. It's magical. It's like the states of mystical meditation that the Bodhisattva sailed through on that eerie night. The sun's light is a steady light. It drives away mystery and shadow. It's warm and life-giving. The moon is the Bodhisattva. The sun is the Buddha. Both lights, the light of awareness, the sun, the light of love, the moon, are integral to Buddhism. But what about the Star of Healing? What about that morning star? The Buddha describes it in more than one place, actually, the morning star. In one place he says, when the light fades into dawn, the Star of Healing shines and glows and flares up. It's after the full moon, it's before the dazzling sun. And it's got a pure and a soft pale light, the light of the eye, the light of a bright eye, a tiny point of perfect awareness. It's not brash, but it outshines all the starry host, the brightest star in the sky. And later on, the Buddha compared the brightness of metta, of loving kindness or friendliness, even friendship, he compares that to the morning star. And he says, just as in the night at the time of daybreak, the Star of Healing shines and burns and flashes forth. Even so, whatever reasons you have got for doing good because you think it'll make life easier, all of these reasons are not worth 1/16th part of the metta, which is the heart's release. Metta, which is the heart's release, alone shines and burns and flashes forth in surpassing all those reasons. Now, what is the morning star? We know, what do we call it nowadays? Does anyone know what the morning star is?
Venus.
It's Venus, the planet Venus. Asadi Taraka is the Indian name for Venus, the most beautiful of the planets. And in Indian Buddhism, it's used as a simile for brightness, for whiteness and purity, and for constancy. Because as an inner planet, unlike the outer planets, it keeps to the same path in the sky in all seasons, never deviating. It represents the path of truth, therefore, of integrity. These are the associations in Indian Buddhism. The word for star is Taraka or Tara. And I imagine that in a sense, when the Buddha slowly opened those newly enlightened eyes, he didn't just see a bright planet in the sky, he saw a living being. And this is basic to Buddhism. Buddhism is an animistic religion in the sense that it recognizes the life that's in everything. So if you see a beautiful tree, that tree is not just a lump of wood, it's a creature. It's a being that you can relate to, you can communicate with in some ways. And the same goes for the stars in the sky, for the moon and the sun, and for Venus, for Ossaditaraka. And that radiant being was reflecting his own enlightenment down deep into his pupils, his Taras of his eyes. And he saw Tara. And again, you may recognize this image I've asked for here. Does anyone know where this is? Anyone?
Downstairs,
that's right, yes. And you may not know, you may not have known who she is, but this is Tara. This is Tara. The name of a female Buddha. So he saw perhaps green Tara, she's green Tara. The other form is white Tara, surrounded by her multiple enveloping shells of rainbow lights, the protective lights of health, skillfulness, and longevity. So if you're interested, do look into white Tara and green Tara and what they symbolize. And white Tara is gleaming pure white, smiling with infinite kindness, and she's got extra eyes in her hands and feet so that her every kind action is fully aware, is fully appropriate. Tara. Ossaditara, the Tara of healing. And also Ossaditara is the planet that we call Venus. Now, for the Greeks and Romans, of course, Venus is the planet of love. That's what you associate it with. The Greek poet Sappho calls her daughter of Zeus, immortal weaver on your gleaming throne. But for the ancient Buddhists, it wasn't the daughter of Zeus, it wasn't the planet of love, but it was the star of healing. And Ossadi, the word for healing, actually means a medicine. It means any medicine, any balm, even any refreshment. But when Venus was in the sky, according to Indian tradition, that is when you should go out to pick healing herbs under the pre-dawn light of Venus. So they had their full potency. So Ossadi, the healing of the healing herbs, was associated with the light shining down, the soft, beautiful healing light of Venus. So you pick them with the dew still cool on the vegetation in the woods. That's when you make your decoctions. That's when you drink them down. That's when they have their curative effect. But this star is a particular kind of healing. It's not the healing of an injured dog crawling into a dark hidden place to lick his wounds, which is a passive kind of waiting for your body to do the healing, which is very valid, of course. That's the healing in a way of the night, you could say. But the star of healing shines on those who want to actively heal themselves. It's to do with actively going out and getting your herbs, understanding the need, understanding the cure and so on, taking the herbs with care, taking them only when they're really needed as well. And very often the Buddha is described as a healer, as a great physician. Or maybe not really the healer, because what he's doing is not healing, but prescribing. He prescribes the remedy. You have to do the healing. And this is the metaphor as the Buddha, as a physician, as a doctor. And this is the Buddha's diagnosing process. So the Four Noble Truths are said to mirror the procedure of a doctor. You diagnose the illness, you find the cause, you identify what a healthy outcome would be, and then you prescribe the cure. So in our human predicament, what is our illness? Our illness is intense frustration, it's dukkha. What's the cause? The cause is a yearning for security and for an identity which nothing can threaten. A yearning which is always doomed to disappointment. That, according to the Four Noble Truths, is the cause of dukkha, the cause of the illness. Can it be cured? Yeah, it can be cured. It's cured when the star of healing gleams in your eyes, i.e. the fully healed condition is full enlightenment itself. How do you get healed? By the remedy prescribed by the great physician. By the herbs you must gather yourself, take yourself under the light of the star of healing. In other words, you get healed by the path, by following the path in all its stages. The medicine is the Dharma itself. In its simplest form, the medicine is the three trainings, the path of three trainings. Living with kindness, ethics, creating bright mental states, meditation, so that you can be aware with less self getting in the way, which is wisdom. These are the medicines. This is the elixir. So in the world, the Buddha is said to be the physician. The whole world needs this healing. And just, I'm going to finish in a way with saying how it is the world is healed and go back to the moonlight of that magical night under the Bodhi tree and go back to a sort of a dream or a vision that the Buddha had according to a description he gave his disciples later. And this is what he says. He says, at the moment of enlightenment, he says, then the thought came to me, I've won the path of enlightenment. I've won the path of enlightenment. There arose in me a vision into things never before called to mind. And knowledge arose, insight arose, wisdom arose, light arose. Light arose. Just as if somebody wandering through the forest along a mountain height should come upon an ancient path, an old track traversed by people of long ago, and should proceed along it, and going along it, then see an ancient city, an ancient capital wherein dwelt folk of former days. The city with gardens, groves, pools, stoutly walled about, a delightful spot, though in ruin. And suppose they should tell of their find to the local ruler or the local governor. Pardon, sire, I would have you know that as I fared through the forest, through a mountain height, I came upon an ancient path, an old track travelled by people of long ago, by men of former days. I followed it, and I discovered an ancient city. Sire, let us restore that city to its former glory. And suppose the ruler or the governor should restore that city. The city should thereafter become prosperous and flourishing, populous, teeming with folk, reaching growth and increase. Even so, I saw an ancient path, an old track which had been walked by Buddhas of ancient times. Isn't that a beautiful little image the Buddha uses, not just of his enlightenment, but of what took him there, and in a sense of what comes next, after the enlightenment. So think of that description, a traveller lost in the forests, perhaps wandering in the deep night shadows, then stumbling on this old overgrown roadway, a few paving stones tumbled about to show where it leads. And I think of that, and I contact a feeling of my own wandering, wandering around in life, sometimes thinking I'm lost in the forest, in the wilderness, sometimes thinking, probably wrongly, that I know what I'm doing. And the feeling of relief in finding in that overgrown forest an old track. Wow, at last, a track. It leads somewhere. Wow, great, maybe I'll find my way out. Overgrown in places, stretches of it, almost completely overgrown, but a real path to follow. And then the city at the end. And I think of that ruined city in the moonlight, the stones, the old temples, paved streets worn by wheels of long, long ago, trees pushing through the old walls. It makes me think of Indiana Jones or maybe Tomb Raider, that's going there, finding these amazing old ruins. Wow, what a place. And the feeling of all the life that once was in that city, now deserted. It's the city of enlightenment, yeah, but it's more than the city of enlightenment, I think, in symbolism. I think of it as the city of the Sangha, the community, the network of friendships which according to Buddhism is indispensable if you are to sustain your practice. It's all very well trying to practice by yourself, but no, you need, unless you're a very unusual person, you need a network, a friendship to sustain you. That is the Sangha, that's the city. So the Buddha didn't sit there under the Bodhi tree in the moonlight and dream and muse on his past and come up with nice images. He wanted to restore the city, but he knew he could not restore the city alone. He didn't just think, oh, I found a city, right, let's get some tools, let's start work on it. He went back. He went back into the world. He went back into his contemporary world. The traveller in his vision goes to talk to the local authorities. And the Buddha marshalled all his own powers to return to the city, but when he returned to the city, he's not alone. He comes with a great company of builders and masons and engineers, architects, gardeners, decorators, and what have you. Town planners, perhaps? And they all open up this road, the ancient trackway to the city of enlightenment. And back and forth they went along the road, keeping it clear, keeping it open, carrying the materials to build the new city, a new city even greater than the ancient one. So they left the moonlight. They let the star of healing rise and do its magic work. They travelled. They worked into the bright day, building a world, building a beautiful city. So I think that's what the Buddha's dream of the ancient city is saying to us. It's not enough to walk up and down a little bit on the old road. If we really want to make a difference in the world, we need to join together. We need to cooperate to restore the ruins of the world, to build a Buddha land, in the traditional phrase. In a traditional Buddhism, it's called building the Buddha land, restoring the world. The city of Buddhism is always going to decay. It'll always start to crumble. The city of the world is always decaying, always crumbling. But the new pure land, the new Buddha land, how is that built? And one of the sutras says, the Buddha land is built out of living beings. Those are the bricks and the mortar. Only we can restore that city. The city is us. We're restoring ourselves as we do it, and restoring ourselves as a community. So when the Buddha's eyes opened on the Star of Healing on that first Buddha day, about 2,550 years ago, the world changed. The whole world changed because of that one person, because of what that one person achieved. Something new started. But what started anew isn't just down to the Buddha's own decisions and life. It's down to the people he knew, the people he taught. And for it to continue, only you and I can do that. We can't leave it to others. So I hope we won't leave the city of enlightenment in its ruined state, but I hope we'll restore it in cooperation with one another. And that's the case, it seems to me, here at the LBC. Sangha, the city, needs creating. And it also needs cherishing. It needs looking after, it needs valuing, it needs rejoicing in. The connections we have with each other, I'm sure, are sometimes difficult. Sometimes we'd rather just be getting on with things. But no, it's really worth putting effort into that, into having friendly, vital communication and connections and assistance with each other. Now, at present, I teach at the West London Buddhist Centre, and I'll be moving over, as Vijayadaka said, to become chair at the North London Buddhist Centre this year. And I'd love the London Sanghas to be more in touch with each other, to keep in touch with each other. I'd love it if people were moving freely between all the different Buddhist centres here in London, especially these Triratna centres in West, North, East London. And this ancient city, London, could become more beautiful if it fills with minds made beautiful by the self-healing power of the Dharma. And that's maybe for the long term. Maybe we won't see very much transformation in London for a few decades. But, you know, you never know. Anyway, here we are today. Maybe starting here, personally, on this festival day, on these celebrations, absorbing the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, trying to find out what it means to us. What do all those events mean? What significance do they have? And then opening our eyes, letting in a little gleam of the Star of Healing, the beautiful, cool clarity of that star, and also seeing that star deep in the pupils of others, of the people around us, a gleam of excitement, a light of the mind clarified by love, is a phrase from Dante, the Italian poet, a light of the mind clarified by love. Now, I love that darkness, the velvety darkness before dawn, as I mentioned. But in a way, I love it because it is, in a way, filled with light. I love it because of my awareness of it. It's not the deep sleep that I like. It's being awake in the darkness and feeling it. I love the sense of awareness that's probing its boundaries, that's sort of pushing further. Awareness reaching out, reaching to my own depths and heights and to that of others as well, reaching out even to reality. That's all that matters, opening our eyes to the gleam of the star of healing, just as the Buddha did. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the London Buddha Centre. Make sure to press the subscribe button, and then please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. It really helps other people to find us. Thank you.